Hello and welcome. My name is Satya Shiva and I will be your host today. NAKPA International is proud to present this teleclass with Pema Chandra Rinpoche. It's on meeting life and death with awareness. My great pleasure to welcome you here today. And before we invite Pema Chandra Rinpoche onto the call, I just want to go over some logistics with you. This will be a 1 hour class. After this class, for members of NAKPA International, there will be a question and answer session, a private question and answer session with Pema Chandra Rinpoche. If you are a member, you will have received an email with a dedicated phone number and PIN, and that will begin at 11 a.m. Pacific time after this call. Also, if you have any technical difficulties during this call, please press the number 5 on your touch-tone phone. By pressing 5, we'll be able to see that and provide some assistance. Finally, it's my great honor and pleasure to introduce Pema Chandra Rinpoche to you now. She is founder of NAKPA International, which is a nonprofit humanitarian organization which preserves and shares Tibetan Buddhist culture. She's also a founder of the Yogic Medicine Institute, which is a natural health organization, which provides education and training and a health clinic and traditional cleansing from the amazing traditions, healing wisdom traditions from India and Tibet. So without further ado, thank you, Rinpoche, for offering us this call today. We are so pleased to be with you live, and we just can't wait to get into this call. So thank you and welcome.
Thank you, Satya. Hello, everyone, and welcome to, I see all of your names here who are here and to our many friends who are joining in later. I'm still especially touched to have the occasion to talk in a heart-to-heart way about such an important subject. Before we begin, I will sing the 7-line prayer in order to bring blessing and energy and clarity to our time together. Om Agyan Yogi Nipchab Sam Pema Kesar Dumpola Yatsen Chogi Nogramne Pema Chumne She Sudrag Kordu Kandro Mangpo Kor Ke Kije Sudag Drabki Jengi Lom Tir Shake Su So Guru Pema Siri Gyan Yogi Nupchup Sam Pema Kesar Dongpo La Yatsen Chogi No Group Ne Pema Jung Ne She Sudra Kordu Kandro Mangpo Kor Ke Ki Je Sudra Draki Jin Gi Lok Jer Shake Su So Guru Pema Seri Hum Kyan Yogi Nukchab Sam Pema Kesar Dongpola Yatsen Chogi Nogram Ye Pema Chung Ne She Sudra Kordu Kandro Mangpo Kor Ke Ki Je Sudra Draki Singi Lov Jer Shake Su So Guru Pema Seri Hello, I am so pleased to see many familiar names here and also old friends as well as some new names and new friends. As you all know, I am Pema Chandra and I'm a teacher in the Nyingma tradition. There are many different kinds of directions from which someone might teach Dharma, for example, in the case of Shakyamuni Buddha or Padmasambhava, the Buddha of India and the Buddha of Tibet, respectively. In their case, their teachings were from the place of perfect realization. In this case, regarding myself, I am only an ordinary person like yourself, but I have a sense of profound love for the Dharma. It is my home and my refuge and an inspiration that overwhelms me. And because of that, and because of my intensive education in Dharma, and because of the blessing and instructions of my teacher and my long history with Dharma, I teach from that place. In this tradition, we believe that ordinary people can offer significant benefit to others if their intention and motivation is sufficient. And so from that kind of orientation, I meet with you today, and with a great sense of humility, especially to try to discuss something so important, so grave, and so profound as the issue of death, death and life, life and death. And I feel completely inadequate to the task and simultaneously have no choice but to share with you my understanding and these teachings to the best of my ability. Also, too, this topic has been covered by some great people in history. Many people say these days, should Vajrayana be taught openly, should it not? And that's a very old argument that comes from Tibet for a long time among the different schools. When should Vajrayana be taught and by whom? And there are a lot of different opinions about that. However, the secret is out, especially in the case of this teaching, which comes from the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is widely taught. It has been published many times in various forms. In 1928, as many of you might have heard of the copies of the Tibetan Book of the Dead from Evans Wentz, the first teaching of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, so-called Tibetan Book of the Dead, was given then. And since then, it has been encountered by major figures of our American culture, or even those who influenced our culture, like Freud and Jung, and even Ralph Metzner and Timothy Leary Metzner. I think I pronounced his name right. Isn't that funny? I can pronounce Tibetan things, but not English things. Timothy O'Leary, and so on. And so this teaching itself is actually, in some sense, not secret. It's been out there, this notion of not just Buddhist teachings on death, but in particular, this really extraordinary, profound Nyingma text that is known as the Tibetan Book of the Dead, even though its Tibetan name is the Bardo of Liberation, or liberation through hearing, quite literally, liberation through hearing in the Bardo, or a guidebook to liberation through hearing for the intermediate state, so something like that. But this text is a very profound Nyingma Dzogchen teaching that is considered of the highest class of teachings. And so even though the secret is out, there are many books on this, both scholarly and non-scholarly, popular culture and non-popular culture-wise, it still remains opaque because the subject matter is so profound. And so in that situation where the secret may be out, but some kind of guide to understanding is still needed, it seems really relevant for those who have an interest in Vajrayana, in Tantric Buddhism, to be able to access some kind of instructions as to the heart meaning and main point and applicability of such teachings, so that you could have an entry into those teachings that would lead you to a vaster and vaster understanding. At some point, on this topic especially, it's not our luxury or privilege to be without the need of such instructions. All of us face death. That is the certainty that we all share. All of us face the death of our loved ones, and all of us live in a life permeated by what is known as bardo, these stages that are like death in that they provide gaps. And so there's a great need and a long history of a teaching on this topic. In particular, today we're in a public phone class. We have a very limited time, only 45 minutes left. And I know that though this is limited, we can at least begin with an introduction. And then, if circumstances allow, I will keep offering these free phone classes on this topic in the coming period of time so that we can go step by step through a particular aspect of the Bardo teaching, the Tibetan Book of the Dead teaching, and that is known as the six root verses of the Bardo. This is a teaching that comes from the Nyingma tradition. I'm a Nyingma teacher. I teach often about the Nyingma tradition, which is one sect, one school of Buddhism. And there are many different approaches within Buddhism, and they're quite diverse. And I feel so passionate and enthusiastic about their diversity because each one showcases a set of methods and a way of looking at reality. And yet at the same time, essentially they have the core principles shared, which is the desire that human beings would be free from suffering, that they would be given access to methods to lead them to great sanity and authentic presence, and so on. And in this case, the teaching that I will give you is from a Nyingma teaching from a Dzogchen text by Karma Lingpa in the 14th century based on treasure revelation. In the Nyingma tradition, this is a special kind of teaching called Terma, treasure revelations, which are quite extraordinary because they are embedded both within the history, the long history of Buddhism, as well as the present context within which those teachings are revealed. And in particular, in the treasure revelation tradition of the Nyingmas, what's so interesting and unique about that, one of the things that's so interesting and unique, is that it has always made a place for and highly valued the role of men and women. In fact, it's understood that in the treasure revelation tradition that if the treasure revealer does not meet with their consort, with their partner, then their counterpart, then they will not be able to reveal these teachings. And in this case, Karma Lingpa, who was the revealer of the Bardo Todal, which is known in the West as the Tibetan Book of the Dead, he found this treasure revelation within a mountain and brought it out. And actually, it was after his mother and child had died that he gave this teaching and revealed this teaching and explained it. The topic of the teaching is known as Bardo, and Bardo is a Tibetan word, and it refers to the intermediate state between birth and death. And this is not just the ultimate birth and death as in the end of our life, death, and then rebirth, but it refers to other moments in one's life where these gaps appear and the continuity that we usually live with in an unquestioning way is suddenly interrupted. And we have a lot of sayings for this in American culture. For example, we say the rug is pulled out from under me, or we have the idea that that there are times when we feel ungrounded, that the ground is gone. And those kinds of disruption in solidity, disruption of continuity, the interruption of certainty are known as bardo. But in particular, the bardo refers to four or six states or even more in the tradition of the Nyingmas. What does the word bardo mean? Often it's translated as intermediate state, and it's that state of being during which we have left the old reality and it's no longer available to us. This is not just a matter of a kind of gradual change where, for example, if you see your child from day to day, maybe then you don't see the changes so dramatically, but then if you're away from them, maybe you have to travel and you're away from your child for 6 months and you see them and the changes seem so dramatic. That perception, which is able to perceive some kind of discontinuity in how it used to be, that is a kind of perception that is available to us in the bardo because it refers to a state of being from which we've completely left the old reality, and it's no longer available to us. And we all experience this most acutely in the death of our loved ones or in the state of our own death, where it is not an option. There's something very radical and very final and total about death. It can't be negotiated with. It can't be rationalized away or excused away or pretended away. And it is complete. And there is a total rupture in how things were. And even with our loved ones, once we lose our loved one, we are no longer the person that we were. That person that we were when they were alive is no longer available to us. And we ourselves go through a great transformation. And so the bardo, a word, the bardo, refers to this intermediate state between one reality and another. And it has a lot of meanings. It refers to the time between death and rebirth, so between one reality and another. It also refers to the end of the old reality. It also refers to the stage of moving towards a new reality and that really radical place in between where we can't anymore sense the old reality and we can't sense the new one either. So there is no ground and there is no certainty and there's no reference point and there's, in a sense, no rest. And that is a very radical place to be in, but it's the place that religion has always been the kind of focal point of, because there we need profound reasoning, not just logic, but something even beyond that that speaks to us in a timeless way and in a way beyond concept and a way that is vast and profound. From the Buddhist point of view, when one person dies, this is not the end of their life. Instead, the idea is that that person has died, but their consciousness, their mind stream, continues. And it continues just as it always has, which is problematic in some way because it continues along the same momentous mind states that it has always had, except these are experienced in a way that is considered thousands, hundreds of thousands of times more intense than we usually experience them in our daily life. And so those same moods and predilections. So if during our daily life we were thinking all the time about war and anger and oppression and the oppressors, then in the time after death, we would experience that with great intensity, grave intensity, a thousand times more intense than usual, and that would become our reality. Or if during our life we thought of love and compassion and cultivated spiritual energy and the benefit of others, and that we meditated on beauty and so on, then after our death, this kind of mind state also would arise to us. And so the idea is that the mind stream continues along the trajectory that it was on during one's life, and then in that time, those same kind of themes appear, but they appear in unfamiliar ways. And if we know how to recognize them and understand them, then a possibility comes for us to find liberation in the place between death and birth. And if we don't understand them, then we solidify into these karmic patterns and take a rebirth in a way that will manifest these patterns again. And so, like this, Buddhists believe that for hundreds of lifetimes, hundreds of thousands of lifetimes, that human beings have recycled and played out repetitive karmic dramas and not liberated from them, only because they don't understand their own minds and they don't know how to recognize what they see during these bardos, whether it be the bardo after death or the bardos that appear during one's life. Of course, the situation is not one in which we're entirely helpless. Buddhists believe that certain rituals can be done by lamas to help people who are journeying from one life to the next so that they can find liberation at that time. However, during that time, unless we have lived a life of continuous practice, we ourselves would not initiate those practices because we continue the practices of the previous life. And so such guidance is really important. I think that this issue of the post-death rituals has to do not only with benefit for the dead, but also the benefit for the living, because experiencing those rituals and going through those practices can be also profoundly healing and liberating for all the family members and loved ones and acquaintances who engage in them as well. And so this is the notion of bardo. In general, there are often talked about 4 bardos or 6 bardos, and in the text that I'll be teaching in these phone classes, the bardos are presented as 6 bardos, the bardo of this life, of meditation, of dream, of dying, of dharmata, and of becoming. And what these refer to are distinct stages in which we have the opportunity to break free from the thick haze of ignorance and the thick haze of karma and suffering and wake up into the true nature of reality, which liberates us and gives us peace. So that is the notion of the bardo, and there is so much more to say about it, but I will leave that to unfold in these teachings. In addition, I would like to say about the 6 root verses of the bardo, which we'll discuss shortly, that it's I chose it because it's connected both to these really profound teachings of these post-death states, and also because it's connected to the 6 yogas of Naropa, which are one of the core practices of the Nagpas, the tradition that I'm from. So the way that this teaching unfolds is that it is a series of 6 prayers, and each of these 6 prayers is an introduction to the essential practices that we should do in this particular stage of life that this prayer refers to. And their prayers are recited, they have a ritual element, but also they can be taken, all the 6 prayers can be taken one by one to be a kind of instruction both for living and for dying. Okay, so I see Jean has a question. Hello, Jean. Hi.
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 So my question is about the way that I'm handling the death of my father. So he died about a month ago, and I've been sad and it was difficult, but I feel like, you know, looking at myself, I'm handling it pretty well. I feel pretty okay. And I was just wondering about that because, to me, I feel like I've grown a lot spiritually, and maybe that's why I'm handling it better than I thought I would. But then I wonder, am I fooling myself or not, and how would I be able to tell?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Well, first I would like to say it's so good to hear your voice. And also, I'm sorry for your loss, and my heart goes out to you and your family. And we were told right away about your father's death and said prayers for him.
Thank you.
So in this situation, I think the question is extremely important because oftentimes when I do funeral rituals for families and work with the loved ones of the deceased over a long period of time, which the Tibetan Buddhist practices require something ongoing, and so there's a period of a few months that I'm in constant contact with the loved ones of the deceased, and this question is really common because of our culture, which the question seems to me, or at least reminds me, of this situation that we have where it's not clear what kind of feelings we should have or should not have after someone dies. And though that wasn't exactly how you framed it, it reminds me of that issue. In other traditions where those issues are delineated really quite distinctively, then it can be more clear. For example, I think of the Confucian tradition where there's a certain period where one wails out loud, and then there's a certain period where one does one kind of mourning ritual, and then there's another period where one now only is doing these rituals at certain times once a year, and then eventually after seven generations then the person is forgotten and so on, and it's really quite regulated. And in the same way in the Tibetan Buddhist funerary practices, it's really quite regulated, and we're given place in these ritual practices for expressing all the various stages of emotions that one would need to go through in order to complete the experience and access the wisdom that is available in mourning our loved ones and the transformation that's available. But in American culture, we don't have those stages so delineated, and those behaviors are not prescribed so specifically. We do have them in the practice of the funeral practice within 1 week that we have, and so that offers some guidance. But then the period after that is highly ambiguous, and how what happens after that can be really surprising. In one case, we might be ready for that state because we have mourned already. Or, for example, in the case of your question that you had emailed, maybe through doing a lot of spiritual practice, we've prepared. And maybe other people have ideas. I know I worked with one person whose husband had died, and her family expected her to be much more depressed than she was a year later, and it was quite an obstacle for her because she was finally moving on from the paralyzing depression that she had felt. And so there's not only our own experience, but the expectations of the ones around us. And again, it's this highly ambiguous state, but there is not a one right feeling. If anything, if there's anything that we can learn as Americans in a pluralistic society where we have so many religious traditions influencing us and so many divergent approaches to this, then one thing that is really clear about the human experience of mourning, which is that there are many different phases of mourning and that they change from day to day and time to time, month to month, and year to year. And as Buddhist practitioners, the essence and core practice for us is always to be present with the experience of mourning that we're going through now. And that might be different than tomorrow's, and it might be the same. And none of those experiences mean something about us per se, but they are each valuable as part of the experience of being alive and part of the experience of relating so deeply with death as we have to do when we're alive. So I say to be present and also refrain from any kind of meaning-making or defining of any of those experiences that might arise as you go through different stages of mourning or different experiences of mourning over time. Okay, good. So now what I would like to do in the remaining 20 minutes is make some time to look at the first of the six verses of the Bardo. As I mentioned before, each of these prayers are a kind of aspiration prayer for finding liberation within the Bardos. And the first one begins with the Bardo of this life. It has many names, and sometimes people may call it by different names, but essentially it's the period from between the moment of birth and the moment when our dying begins. When the Bardo of this life is dawning upon me, I will abandon laziness, for there is no time to waste in life. I will enter the undistracted path of hearing, thought, and meditation, making mind and appearances as the path. I will manifest the Trikaya. Now that I have attained a human body, there is no time to linger on distractions. And so this verse begins with this notion that we have a short time in this life, and this, of course, is the central theme of Buddhahood, and Buddhism is a kind of razor-like sense of both presence and impermanence. One really requires the other. If we don't have a sense of impermanence, we can't be present because we're always hanging on to everything that was before, and that becomes like a baggage that obscures our attention so that we're not able to be present. Also, the notion of impermanence really points to something about the nature of reality, which is that sense by which everything is ungraspable and insubstantial and so infused with our own mind and mental projections. So the prayer begins, when the Bardo of this life is dawning upon me, that moment when we enter into life, then it has this aspiration, may I abandon laziness and not waste time in life. And if there's anything that the death of our loved ones and our own death teaches us, definitely about time and wasted time, especially the inconsequential times like daily life and little moments of time. Little moments of time are, that's a term that I refer to when I'm talking about those moments of our life that seem inconsequential, that they are not, they're maybe not even the greatest or worst, but they're just one of hundreds of millions of little moments that go by. And so those little moments of time and also daily life, that we do have this experience of such times with such speed and such momentum that is pushed by our karma that it's hard to notice them and it's hard to appreciate them until we lost them. And the thing about karmic momentum and that speed of daily life is that there is a kind of urgency about it that pulls all of us. And I know, myself included, it would be so easy for us if time stopped, and once a day all of time stopped, everything in the world stopped, demands and urgencies all stopped for us, and there was no choice for us but just to rest and be aware and present and cultivate spiritual energy. But it's not like this. Instead, in the midst of that experience of extreme momentum and overwhelming speed caused by our karmic existence and ordinary life context, that in that state of overwhelming speed and momentum, that is where we are expected to do spiritual practice, to find profound meaning, to benefit others, that we're somehow supposed to cultivate this profound stillness in the midst of that, which is really quite a radical thing. However, there's one thing that helps us to do that, which is a moment when we realize that we have wasted time. And that can be really strong. There can be a beautiful sense of poignant appreciation of wasted time when we see that something's too late, maybe because a relationship is gone, or because we've lost that job, or because we've reached a certain age, and that age to us makes us look back and see what we have not done, and so on. And usually in such times, in the bardo of this life, we often see those moments for what they are, which is a kind of rupture, a kind of pausing, but then we occupy them with the same kind of mindset that we usually have conducted our whole life with. And this becomes a wasted opportunity. So in this prayer we say, I will abandon laziness, for there is no time to waste in life. And I think for myself included, and for Americans in general, our form of laziness is extreme busyness, which reflects a sense of lack of priorities, lack of making choices, and a sense of allowing situations and circumstances to govern us. And also this laziness is a kind of not holding to what is most deep and most important, which we've all seen at times. We've seen it at times, and yet it's easy to lose hold of that because it takes so much training. It takes so much discipline. It takes so much cultivation, deliberate cultivation, to remember that which is most important, to hold to it, and to organize one's life around it. But in the case of this prayer, to not do so is called laziness. When the bardo of this life is dawning upon me, I will abandon laziness, for there's no time to waste in life. Of course, we feel we have all the time in the world until we realize that we do not. And then it's irrevocable and things move very quickly. So the Buddhists try and address this by often having prayers about remembering impermanence and having symbols of impermanence around us. And experience can definitely be a great initiator into this notion that there is no time to waste. I remember years ago I was speaking with Dr. Rinpoche, and of course I would like to pause and just say a word of appreciation towards Gungten Tulku and Dr. Rinpoche, my own teachers, who without whose compassion my life would be very dim indeed. But I one time was asking Dr. Rinpoche about something, and he said, well, there's great obstacles to deal with. And I wrote him back and I said, What obstacle? It was just in regards to a particular situation, thinking, well, maybe I can help remove that obstacle. And he said, well, the obstacle is limited time. And I thought of that and savored that comment repeatedly over the years, realizing that is the great challenge that we're in, that We have so much possibility and so much desire. It's so much distraction, and we have limited time, and we have to be very choiceful about how we occupy it. When the bardo of this life is dawning upon me, I will abandon laziness, for there is no time to waste in life. Entering the undistracted path of hearing, thought, and meditation, or it would be listening, contemplating, and meditating. So we have in this life the opportunity to find liberation in the bardo. That is an unmistakable aspect of all of Buddhist teachings that they all have in common, is this notion that during this life it's possible for us to cultivate the mind state that leads to liberation. And we can do so by hearing the teachings, contemplating their meaning, and experientially engaging with them through practices. Making mind and appearances as the path, I will manifest the Trikaya. So this prayer of the Bardas begins with this bold and beautiful aspiration. First, I will manifest the Trikaya, which means basically Buddhahood. It refers to Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya, and so on, which is the enlightened manifestation of body, speech, and mind. And so thinking of bardo, thinking of these points of junction, usually in such times, we're so lost that what we're really looking for is certainty and ground. And here that place is filled up with resolve. And that resolve is this determined aspiration for liberation, that I would manifest the Trikaya. That means in my body, speech, and mind that I would fully awaken. And how do we do that? It says making mind and appearances as the path. What does this mean? It's a very extraordinary statement, and even from the different schools of Tibetan Buddhism, we could understand it in various ways. But one view is that we see that everything that arises is actually a reflection of our own mind state. And for the Nyingma tradition, this doesn't refer to a kind of perspective where the entire world is only made of mind, but instead the idea that the world as we experience it is completely composed of our minds, that our experience is absolutely not just tainted by and flavored by our own mind state, not just informed by our own karmic predilections, but that it is circumscribed by that mind content which we are carrying inside of us. That it is actually defined completely, that the limits of our situation are set by this state of mind that we carry, our capacity for awareness, our understanding of karma, our understanding of reality, our mental habits, that every experience is completely determined by that. And that's why they have this idea of appearances in Buddhism, this notion that what we see isn't a definite, absolute, external reality, but instead it's things as they are appearing to be to our mind. It also has another greater meaning, of course, which is how the entire world of ordinary existence appears versus how it actually is. And if we have that sense of seeing our experiences as they arise as appearances, then questions naturally arise from such a view that would never come up because we're not taking things definitively that they are a certain way or have to be a certain way. But now we begin to see that they are appearing a certain way due to our mind states. And if we practice and can transform and change our mind states, one of the first things, of course, we all see is how much things appear differently to us. Making mind and appearances as the path, I will manifest Buddhahood, the three kayas. Now that I've attained a human body, there is no time to linger in distractions. So one really important point of these prayers for the bardo that I read the first of the six today, one really important point that permeates all of them is this sense of the nowness of the need to practice, to study Dharma, to liberate our minds, to devote ourselves to benefiting others and freeing this world from suffering. We always think we'll have time later, and there is no later. There is no time to linger on diverting sidetracks or distractions. When the bardo of this life is dawning upon me, I will abandon laziness, for there is no time to waste in life. Entering the undistracted path of hearing, contemplation, and meditation, making mind and appearances as the path, I will manifest Buddhahood, the three kayas, awakened body, speech, and mind. Now that I have attained a human body, there's no time to linger in distractions. So we'll leave this conversation on the bardos in a kind of suspension itself until next time. And I look forward to that occasion, and I hope that circumstances will allow us to meet again and go through the whole six prayers. One last note that I would like to make as I present these bardo teachings to you is that people often ask me what they can do for their loved ones who have died. And certainly we have practices, many elaborate practices that can be done. But even in essence, if we think about these Shitro practices, the practices for the dead, and the elaborate ritual funeral rites that are there and so on, that all of these are kinds of loving prayers for the liberation of your loved one, that they would be liberated, that they would fully awaken, that they would find peace, that they would be free from suffering, that they would find wisdom, and so on. And it's that kind of prayer, that intention for their awakening and liberation, the same prayer that we make every day as Buddhists, but really amplified and directed towards that person, that's really the essence of all these practices. And so I encourage you to make those prayers, whether they be the Buddhist prayers that fall into particular practices or from whatever religious perspective that you might come from, that Buddhists believe that those altruistic aspirations actually are so beneficial and helpful for ourselves and others that they're not only a kind of prayer to something external, but they're an expression of our own innate nature, of our natural state. To even think like that or feel that is to taste a bit of the natural state of your own Buddha mind. So I leave you with that contemplation, and I would like to say thank you and remind you that today's teaching happens only because of a network of generosity that is completely miraculous and beautiful that Nagpa International has been able to occupy. We started as a school for Buddhism and have grown now to into our international aspiration to sustain the Nagpa tradition and preserve that heritage. It's so easy in our idea that we would preserve the culture of Tibet to overlook these smaller local cultures and local traditions like that of the Nagpas that are outside the government and outside major institutions, but really represent a defining element of Tibetan Buddhism and Tibetan culture that has played a major role throughout its entire history. And so in order to advocate for that, we recently had expanded the goals of our organization and in doing that, changed to NACPA International, the name of our nonprofit, and are now taking even bolder steps to really continue not just sowing the seeds that we've sown before, but now that they're starting to blossom, to be able to nourish these and help NACPAs worldwide, as well as preserve these teachings and make them available to the public. As you all know, if you know me, then you know that I believe these teachings are so imperative and relevant because they approach Buddhism from the non-monastic perspective, which is where Westerners come from. And so they should know teachings that are made for people who have relationships and families and work life and these complex situations. There is a Buddhist tradition that has, for the last 1,000 years, devoted itself exclusively to practices that would aid such people. And especially in the case of Buddhist Tantra, where the heart idea, the essence idea, is that we would make use of our everyday experience, that becomes our retreat, that becomes our spiritual nourishment if we know how to work with it. And so I devote this class and all of our activities of NACPA International for that purpose, that you would receive the nourishment of that profound heritage of the Buddhist yogis from India and Tibet, and that it would not only benefit you, but it would be sustained and continue to benefit American Buddhism in the future. That could never, ever happen if I didn't have the daily help of so many people, and especially the members who sponsor our organization through their monthly membership, including all of the members who have donated over time as great patrons of so many projects that we have done over the years, as well as ongoing patronage. For example, I would like to say thank you to Lobsang, who is a great supporter of my Lama activities and through whom so many classes have come through. So I say thank you to all those whose generosity makes this occasion possible, and also to my personal students, especially Aruna and Satya and Daidzin, Chimei and Trogyal and Chandala and all of these people like Choying, who their service and cooperation is the practical engine that made it possible for you to hear about this teaching, for us to have the Maestro Conference, the call on, for us to have a website and so on. So I'm so grateful to them. I know that, for example, Miko had to learn technology just so that we could host the webcast. So many times, not everyone is like Ray, who's just born with all this technical knowledge. And of course, we know he also works at it. But all of this service comes from so many different backgrounds. Maybe they learned it just for the purpose of serving the Dharma. Maybe they instead donate their expertise. It's such a wide variety of generosity expressions that makes this occasion possible. So I just thank all of you for being such an inspiration and example to me. Finally, I would like to make a few announcements. As you know, we have ongoing classes. It's been my goal to reach people in their homes in a really convenient way, so that I can make Vajrayana education accessible and in-depth. In-depth Vajrayana education requires for it to be ongoing, but because of our lifestyle as Americans, not everyone can take time off work for a few years to study Dharma every day, nor is that necessary. Instead, you can study Dharma every day in your life, in your families, and while at work, and I want to help make that possible for you, like NACPAs of the past have. So we have our ongoing programs, one of which is the Vajrayana Training 2, and I invite you to join us for that. It should be a juicy and controversial time, as always, especially since Vajrayana Training 2 looks at the five most controversial issues, I think, of all time of Dharma, which is the conduct of the yogis of Buddhist Tantra. What are the guidelines, the ethics, the morality, the decision-making, the purpose, the constraints, the freedoms, and so on. So that will be an opportunity that's opening. I think maybe Satya can tell us, but it's something in June or July. We're starting the next session. Also in May, I'm coming to Berkeley this year in order to have a very big event in August where we're having the Nagpa Festival. We're having Nagpas come from Bhutan, Tibet, and of course the American Nagpa, you know, which is me, and so on, to gather together to teach about the Nagpa tradition for 5 days in Berkeley. And so this will be a beautiful opportunity for us to celebrate this new period, as well as give you a chance to get profound empowerment. Sewang Rinpoche is going to give the empowerment of all the practices in the terma of Pegya Lingpa, who is a Buddhist yogi of great importance in our tradition. So we're going to have quite a big occasion, and that'll be in August. So due to that plan, we planned fewer big events in Berkeley in order to make it possible for people to travel for one longer event in August. As a result, the only other time I'm coming this year is in May, so please make special efforts to come and see me because you won't have many chances this year. I hope that we'll have the chance to be together. Also, it's always a great treat for me to see you and have the chance to talk with you. So in May, I'll come to Berkeley. And this class today launches the theme that I will be staying with the entire time, which is looking at birth, death, and reincarnation in the Buddhist tradition. So please join us in Santa Cruz and Berkeley and so on. You can find out about that on our website, and maybe Satya will tell us something. Oh, and we have our newsletter, thanks to Chime and Trusha as well, and Choying. Finally, before I say goodbye, also, I would like to invite you to be my tweetheart and to see me on Facebook. Myself and several of my students, Chime, Malika, and Dadeson, all work together for those postings to stay continuous. I go off of it for some periods. I come on it for some periods, but all the while, they're delivering all kinds of little goodies, and or I'm using them as the medium to post messages. So it's just a way for us, if you'd like to stay in a more consistent communication through all of your modern devices. So you can be my tweetheart by signing up on Twitter for Lama Pema Khandro, or Facebook, it's Pema Khandro Rinpoche. So thank you very much again, and thank you to Satya. And I will end our time together by saying this Bardo prayer again one more time. May we have this prayer in our heart and hopefully just even actualize a fraction of its aspired meaning. When the Bardo of this life is dawning upon me, I will abandon laziness, for there's no time to waste in life. Entering the undistracted path of hearing, contemplation, and meditation, making mind and appearances as the path, I will manifest the three kayas. Now that I have attained a human body, there is no time to linger on distractions. Thank you very much, and I invite all the Vajrayana training students to meet me now for our private question and answer time. Let's end with Om, Ah, and Hung. Om. May all beings everywhere be freed from suffering and its true cause. All beings everywhere experience happiness and its true cause. Fruit of this teaching in all the activities of our school be to accomplish the greatest benefit for all beings everywhere and all things everywhere. Everyone, everywhere, experience the joy, purity, dignity, and fearlessness of peace. All beings everywhere know peace.
Thank you so much, Rinpoche. It is always such an illuminating experience to hear your teaching, and what a blessing it is to be able to do it by this teleclass format. So glad that this is offered and that we can gather together from all over the planet to hear these teachings. So thank you, and I do pray that your teachings will continue and continue. For information about the upcoming events that Rinpoche talked about, her May teachings in the Bay Area, and also the upcoming Vajrayana training part 2, please go to our website, www.buddhistyogis.org. That's buddhistyogis.org, and all the details will be there. We'll now begin our private question and answer session for the members. If you are a member, you've received your call-in information in your email box, and so we will start that directly following this call. Thank you again, Rinpoche, for this time together with you today. It's truly extraordinary to be with you. Thank you so much. And I bid you all a hearty farewell now, and we hope to meet you all again and again. Have a wonderful day.